This is episode 1-4 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome to the Software Freedom Law Show. Bradley has a topic he'd like to talk about today, so we have a we're going to have a non-interview show today.
Well, it sounds like you're putting me on a podium. I was hoping we could discuss and debate the
issue. Sure we won't be able to help ourselves but discuss it.
Well, we should debate or whatever you want.
We'll discuss.
Discuss, okay. That's fine. Well, we don't know what position you're going to take anyway. You might take the same position as me, though we can't have a debate.
I think we do see generally eye to eye about this topic.
This topic, indeed. Well, this topic came to my mind when I saw a blog post by Monty Videnos, who is famous for as one of the original developers of MySQL, and of course the company was sold to Sun, and now will become part of Oracle. And he wrote a blog post, and we'll link to it in the show notes, which talks about the way he designed the original MySQL business model and how it's changed over time and how Sun has done different things with it. And he's trying to talk about that specific business model and inspired me to think about the general space of GPL business models. It's a question I used to get when I used to go around speaking about free software, you know, 10 years ago, 8 years ago. And it's not a topic I talk about as much anymore because I sort of think that everybody's figured this out. But when I see things like this, I think people sometimes are in pigeonholes about what's possible under the GPL.
Well, it's funny that you said you think people have figured it out because when I was trying to interrupt you earlier, it was because I was going to say, well, let's back up a moment and talk about what kinds of business models there are for GPL companies. And, you know, so it's kind of funny you're saying that we'll have all figured it out. But, you know, obviously the dual licensing model is one of the ones
Don't say dual licensing.
Relicensing model.
Well, I usually call that particular business model the proprietary relicensing business model. Mainly because the word dual licensing has been used over time to refer to three distinct different practices in the free software world.
Which we've discussed in earlier episodes.
I don't like to make commitments on the air, but I will make a commitment that I will find the show we discussed it in and we'll link to it because I know we discussed it. It's a big commitment.
It is a serious
commitment,
but I actually think I remember which show it was.
Okay,
so
good. You'll save me. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, I think it's important to describe things in precise detail. And the proprietary relicensing business is the one that Monty's talking about that MySQL used for many years, and Digium uses it for Asterisk now, and there's a number of companies that use it as a model. You said you want to go through all the list of business models. I think it almost biases the discussion when you say, well, let's list the business models possible with the GPL, because it sort of presupposes that that somehow the GPL is so foreign to business that you have to go and figure out what the business models are.
That's not actually what I meant.
I know you personally didn't mean that, but I think a lot of people do mean that when they ask, what are the business models?
Yeah, I just thought it was nice to frame our discussion to think about the different ways that people have, you know, started for-profit enterprises around the GPL. But you're right, it's something that has been hashed out. And
there's probably a caveat we should say. We are nonprofit people. We work for a nonprofit.
That's true also, is that we deal almost exclusively, but not exclusively, with nonprofits. And so we're much more familiar
with the nonprofit. We're also both employees of a nonprofit. We volunteer for nonprofits. So most of our thinking is around nonprofits. But, you know,
you can't be active in the free software space without being familiar with for-profit activity.
Not only that, but I was going to add, you know, on the weekends, I do for-profit free software business activity to make extra money. And I've done that basically since 1996, I want to say, maybe 94, I started actually making money doing free software. So as a consultant, it seemed completely natural to me that you could make money with GPL software because I started doing it very, very early in my career.
And at some point, I'd really like to do a show about talking about volunteers in free software projects versus working for companies and how that sometimes can become awkward.
Well, I think we're going to touch on it some here because I think that really influences the question of how businesses make money around free software. And I think our community discourse about this issue has gotten into a little bit of a rut because of that thing I was talking about, where people think there's some list of business models that are GPL appropriate and they are foreign and different and we have to, wow, we have to bang
out. It also implies that we've discovered all the ways in which GPL software enters into business models, which is also not true.
Yeah, that's a good point. Although on the other side of that, I kind of feel that there's nothing new under the sun. That the way you make money in software, maybe there's some other way to make money in software we haven't discovered yet. Just generally in the software world, GPL, non-specific to any way of making money with software, and there probably are. But the thing is that the traditional bread and butter ways that people make money with software are. I'm sorry, I just had totally distracted myself because I said bread and butter and I realized that could be offensive to vegans saying butter.
I don't think vegans would be offended.
Not offended,
the term butter because there's also apple butter.
That's true. That's true. Which does not have any animal products.
You can have vegan forms of butter.
Sorry, I went totally meta there. I apologize. But the traditional ways that people make money in software, they all generally work in the GPL space, right? Most people in the software world make money...
There's almond butter.
There's now you're off
butter.
Topic. Okay. So,
all right.
But the traditional software ways of making money, improving the software on contract. Somebody hires you to make the software better. You provide a service related to the software. You get paid to develop software that fits a specific need people have. These are the traditional ways people have made money in the software industry since the
70s.
Yeah. But what do you mean specifically by free software on hardware?
I was just thinking of vendor business models.
As far as they have some new hardware product and they want existing free software ported. In fact, that's an interesting one to mention because this Cygnus, which is really people forget this, and I think Michael Tiemann, who's now the CTO of Red Hat these days, people don't give him enough credit for historically he was the first guy to really build a hardcore business, really successful. Totally focused around the GPL code base, which is Cygnus Solutions, which provided exactly what you said for GCC. They would port GCC to new hardware. And I always tell the story because it's lost in the annals of free software history and it's not really talked about except by me. But there was a time in the late 90s when there was a story going around that if you wanted GCC ported to a new chipset, you had to plan early because Cygnus was the only company equipped to do it because they had the best GCC engineers available, and you had to book 18 months in advance just to get an engineer's attention, let alone finish the project. So they were just had some more work that they could do with. And at one point in my career, I said, I'm going to learn the GCC code base because it's sure employment forever because there's some, if they're 18 months out booked, well, they must be. And Cygnus had basically an open call. Any GCC engineer who wanted a job could have one. Of course, many of them worked elsewhere.
Right.
So they didn't want a job at Cygnus, which sort of goes to another point, I think, which is that having lots of small consulting companies doing work is really a fundamental and important component of
and what do you mean by small, right? Because I was just looking up, for example, I was just looking up the number of employees at Red Hat, and I saw that in their quarterly report. And this is another example of me geeking out over filings, but in their annual report, they said that they had over 2,800 employees as of February of this year, which is a lot. But arguably not a huge company, a large company at 2,800 employees. So you mean less than 100 employees, small companies, or
that's
less
what
than 25 employees?
I'm thinking around the less than 100.
Okay.
And certainly less than 25 as well. You know, when you look at, and I think GCC is a great example here. I know people don't like to geek out about compilers, but it's a good case study because it is a GPL code base that exists longer than pretty much any other except for Emacs. So you have a code base starts in 1989, roughly. And there has been consistent for-profit activity basically since 91, 92. And it's mostly been throughout various small companies. So you have companies like Code Sorcery, which people probably haven't heard of. It's run by a guy named Mark Mitchell. And that's a relatively small company. They're private, so I don't know exactly the size, so you couldn't actually look it up.
We could ask Mark.
But we could ask Mark if we really wanted to know exactly. But I know it's a relatively small company. I would guess it's still under 25. If I've said the wrong number, Mark can write in and correct us. But I think his business model and other people's business model like that are really good for GPL codebase, and here's why. Because when you get a community of companies, you have a balance in the software development community of people with different interests pushing in different directions and having to cooperate. When one company controls the code base, then you get a certain amount of proprietariness, even though the license is GPL.
Bradley, I never expected you to make such a strong capitalist argument.
Well, you know, I'm not opposed to free as in market.
Right.
I like free as in freedom, I like free as in price, and I like free as in market. And I think what big companies do, and you know, as we know from the monopolist in the U.S., Microsoft, they tend to push out competition. And I think this small company, small business model around free software is really fundamental to the health of free software. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because politicians always talk about this. They always say, you always hear people in Congress saying, well, this percentage of businesses are small business, usually a high percentage, somewhere over 50. I don't actually know the number. And of course, how you classify small business is a question as well. But the thing is, there are a lot of small businesses in the United States, and it really is an important part of at least the United States economy. I'm sure it's probably important elsewhere as well. And I think that the building a software industry around that size company, it is the best software industry that we can make. Mm-hmm. So when people talk about how do I get a bunch of VC money and grow my company until it turns into Google, you know, the GPL is probably not the best license for that. And when I see people complaining, there's been articles lately, again, we're going through this thing in the press again where people are saying the GPL is not a business-friendly license, which I'm not even going to link to the articles or quote them because I don't want to give them any more press. Uh-huh. Because it's just FUD, really, because it's maybe true that it's hard to make a gigantic business out of a GPL software, but making a small business that employs you and a small group of people to do interesting work is...
Well, and it's a real point of, it's a real sales point for your clients. I mean, you know, that they know that they're getting something where they're not wholly dependent on you, but you're going to be the best provider of whatever services that are necessary or getting up and running on whatever it is that they need, that knowing that there's a whole, you know, base out there for support should you decide to move out of the country is a good thing.
Yeah.
And you look at sales point.
And it's not, I mean, and we've seen the same model grow in other places. You look at communities like the Joomla community or the Drupal community and these web framework, spaces. They're doing very similar things to what GCC happens. The code bases are totally different, but what's happening is they're going into places, they're getting it working for that particular customer. They're pushing the interesting bits that can be generalized back into the core. And the GPL code base in the case of Joomla is growing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know Drupal as well, but I'm sure that's the case there as well. So I think we have to really look at what's working and how healthy the communities are. And I think, you know, I like Monty Videnos a lot, and I like the MySQL project, but I think the pains that it's going through right now are sort of a case study in the long-term effects of the relicensing business model. Hmm. Because I think that they got sold and they got sold again, and now there's the code base is fractured.
That's true, actually, because MySQL is always pointed to as the example.
But it's I think it's the wrong example. This is why for years I've always pointed at places like Code Sources and pointed to the history of Cygnus and said, look at those free software business models that didn't really have any problems as they grew. I mean, Cygnus was, you talk about Red Hat being a big company. Well, one of the things that Red Hat did, I think the smartest thing Red Hat ever did was acquire Cygnus right after their IPO when they had all that extra cash from the IPO. That was the most profitable and strong free software company out there. And Red Hat made a good decision in acquiring it, I think. And that's one of the reasons they grew.
Right.
So my feeling is that these business models are just, they're not GPL business models. They're software business models that work well with a license like the GPL. And I also want to see people look more towards the health of their free software community as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense, and for some of the reasons that I was mentioning before, that it benefits everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that in some sense it's becomes a free as in price versus free as in freedom question to some extent. Because the code base, when it's out there and being well funded by a single company, either because that company got VC money or because they've got enough money coming in from the proprietary relicensing business, it all seems well and good. And the community sort of feels, oh, we're getting all this code and they're generating more and more code and it's all coming out under GPL. And that's certainly the situation that was the case for MySQL for many years. It's a situation with Asterisk now. Mm-hmm. And I think when times are high and everything's going well, it feels like, well, this can only get better in this business model. But because all the developers end up getting hired by one company and the community is consolidated inside one company, it doesn't create the kinds of free software communities we see from the historic volunteer-oriented communities that were volunteer first and became businesses later.
Yeah, I mean, I think that often, you know, you often see that in companies that free some of their code but don't take real steps to build community, and it's part of the desire to keep control, to remain the one big participant in that space. And it's sort of a symptom of the same problem.
Oh, you've totally just inspired me to rant about Open Core. Should I rant about Open Core?
Go for it.
Okay, I'm going to rant about Open Core.
The Bradley Soapbox Show.
I didn't want to turn into that. You know, you opened with that we were going to do that, and it kind of has turned into that. But I think that we're seeing that problem with the Open Core space. So the Open Core business model, which I just think is in a lot of ways a travesty, is basically a twist on the proprietary relicensing business model, making it a little more proprietary, which is you have this core, which you keep all the copyright to, and you do proprietary licensing on the core. And then on top of that, you use the proprietary licensing to have various different add-ons and improvements that you sell to customers who pay you, and you only give it to them under proprietary license. And then, of course, the company hires somebody that they call a community manager, which really just means somebody who's going to get people to volunteer to give their code to this company so the company can make money and they can.
Now, not all community leaders or community managers are in that role. I just want to...
I'm talking specifically about the person at a quote open core company who is labeled community manager.
Okay.
I'm not talking about every person with the title community manager. Good. To be clear.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a title at one point that was somewhat like that, so I mean, I'd be insulting myself anyway.
I mean, you know, that is definitely a problem, and sometimes that's a problem when you when companies are forcing assignment. As well.
Well, yeah, and of course they have to force assignment in the proprietary relicensing model.
Oh, well, they have to in the proprietary licensing model.
And the open core guys, guys are basically just a proprietary relicensing model plus even more proprietary stuff. You know, and I just find it troubling. I mean, honestly, I think that the outcome of it is, well, this really is my rant show. The outcome of it is ultimately going to be that the companies won't be successful in the sense that they won't see a real benefit from the fact that they put stuff out under open source. They won't really get any benefit from
right.
it, because the benefits that you get from free software, and I'm actually picking my terms very carefully. I said open source before, and now I'm saying free software here, because the benefits of free software were that there was this vibrant community of lots of contributors.
Right, and this is what I was alluding to before.
Yeah.
You don't get that vibrant community when you're trying to be the only actor in the space, and often you see sort of like, I wouldn't say feigned attempt at community, but that's what they
turn into. Yeah, and I should reel back what I said before in some sense, that they aren't feigned attempts. In fact, they're very genuine attempts, because they believe that open source will help their business. I think what a lot of these companies are discovering, that having an open core, it didn't really change their business much from if it had been a proprietary, because they're not getting contributions from the community. They're not getting interest from the community. And people who are out there giving patches, they don't feel part of the whole structure.
Which is really unfortunate, because it sometimes means that people think they've tried the free software business model, and then they don't see the benefits from it. And,
exactly.
And then they abandon it.
They think the only business model is open core / proprietary licensing, hire a community manager, try to get people out in the community to contribute to you, and when they contribute well, just hire them.
Right.
That business model, it wasn't a good business model to start with, in my view. It was successful in a few cases for a limited time.
Yeah.
That's my view on that business model.
And it's so hard to watch, too, because it's, you know, it turns people off to free software when it has nothing to do with free software.
Correct. It has to do with open source. I mean, to use the distinction. In fact, for these two terms.
I disagree with the,
because the thing
very strongly,
right,
in that way.
And when I make these complaints to, in fact, I had a dinner at OSCON during the first. Actually, it was at the Community Leadership Summit the last day. We had a dinner with, and I was sitting at a table with, basically a table full of community managers for open core companies,
mm-hmm.
And I gave this rant, and I got a lot of negative feedback, as you might expect. But the thing that they taught me in that dinner was that they believed that they were genuinely doing something community oriented, which I believe mm-hmm. completely. Mm-hmm. And also, they had a sense. They had a sense that I was somehow criticized, saying, you know, you give me all this code and all I'm going to do is complain at you. Which I know it might come across that way, but I think what I'm trying to say is that you're not going to reach your goals doing it this way.
Right.
Because your goals are to build a community where you can get contributing people and have a vibrant interest in your code base, which doesn't actually get generated. You just, only your customers are going to be interested in the mm-hmm. end because there isn't a community.
Now you'll see some benefit from having your customers being able to contribute, you know, sure. which is a real advantage for free and open source software. Mm-hmm. But you won't get the extent of community that you would get.
Yeah, on the other hand, that happens at proprietary companies because lots of customers of proprietary companies have a code license and can get back.
Yeah, that's true.
And that
it sort of depends.
It does depend. Yeah. I mean, I've certainly been in situations long ago in my career when I was at a company and wished I had even mm-hmm. just that much and didn't. But a lot of business models that are proprietary are like that. I mean, the thing I'm really afraid of, and this is the kind of thing that keeps me up at night, is that we may be past the moment where we can generate those kinds of GCC-like communities, code bases that are first volunteer-oriented and then the business is built around them and then it's vibrant and continues on ad infinitum. Because it's really difficult to get people to write free software as a volunteer to start. Because there are so many companies putting out large code bases that are under GPL, so people are saying, well, why would I even contribute as a volunteer to anything?
Right.
Because I can get paid for it, so, and it's still GPL'd, and I might as well follow the code bases that people are paying for, which creates these siloed GPL open query things, which may or may not succeed, and then there's no volunteer
right, and that's one base. Of the things that I heard discussed a lot at OSCON, I think, because you guys, I missed the, there's a FLOSS Foundations mm-hmm. meeting that I missed, and I think it was mm-hmm. discussed there as well, yeah. that in fact, having these companies that hire or that because there are so many developers that are so many I don't know why I'm having such a hard time saying this, but so many of the developers who are working on any particular project are hired by one or two companies that no one wants to participate as a volunteer. It effectively kills the whole volunteer community. Yeah, but I don't know if I buy that.
I don't.
That was the argument.
That was mostly Simon Phipps' argument, I think. Simon Fisk was the key person in that argument. I don't want to represent his position exactly, but he was sort of raising this issue of the community and hiring people and so forth.
I think for that reason, a lot of nonprofits choose not to fund development.
Yeah, and I find that unfortunate. You know, traditionally FSF, that was what FSF was made for. It's kind of weird to think about now because it's been years and years and years since FSF did that.
It's a real advocacy organization
correct.
Now.
But up until about 1995, that was FSF's mission.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked really well, I think. And it didn't work, Stallman's fond of saying, that what happened was, from the point of view of FSF, it just got more and more volunteers because companies started paying people to work on GPL software. And from the nonprofit's point of view, that's a volunteer who's working on their code base.
Right.
So there was no need to fund the development anymore because so many volunteers, quote unquote, showed up. And I think the counterbalance to that ends up being that developers being paid have an agenda that belongs to the company.
Yeah.
And actually, Dave Neary at OSCON gave a really good talk where he talked about various different community patterns and things happening in community. And one of the things is that when you look at a free software developer, you have to see where his attentions are being pulled and negatively. And he said things like, you know, Twitter and, you know, random mm-hmm. attention grabbing things that ads or whatever. But he also said their manager. Mm-hmm. Because from the point of view of the free software project, what the developer's manager wants is not necessarily the goal of the free software project. It's the goal of that company.
Right.
And so the question is, how do we balance that? And how do we set up scenarios where people can be funded to work on free software, but aren't pulled in the direction of some large company?
And it's something that free software projects from a nonprofit perspective have to be really aware of, because a lot of the board members and key people who are involved with the project and its decision making are really having their agenda often driven by the companies they work for. Now, that's not always the case either, but it is sometimes the case, and it's something you have to really be aware of and clarify, you know, whether they're representing their personal views as a key developer of the free software project or if they're representing the company.
Yeah, and I think the challenge of it it's not what I want to say. But what I want to say is the way to solve it is to have lots and lots of different companies funding the development. I mean, I've been using GCC as an example, but I think Linux as a project mm-hmm. fits a very similar example. Linus started as a volunteer project. It was stayed a primarily volunteer project for its early years. Eventually, companies started employing people that worked on it, but it had such a strong existence that it was never under the control of any one specific company. Even when Linus, for example, worked at Transmeta, there was all this fear when Linus went to work for Transmeta that somehow Transmeta was going to control Linux in some way because Linus worked there. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the Linux community was so strong already by then that there was no way. Even employing Linus was not enough to control all of Linux. And that's still not the case today. So I think that, as I was saying before, we're in a dangerous time. Because I don't know anymore how to start projects like GCC, like Linux, like Samba is another example mm-hmm. like this. I don't know how to make those projects start anymore, or how to turn projects that are teetering on the edge of being a little too just in the one camp of one company into being more vibrant communities. So if people have ideas on how to do this, they should email me because I'm at a loss.
I mean, I think as needs present themselves, I think a lot of times developers step up, and you'll see, I mean, what we are seeing is some projects being developed in the academic space, and as universities get more willing to release their code under free and open source software licenses, that seems to be what I'm seeing more of.
Mm-hmm. That's one possibility. I'm more skeptical and less hopeful were the two mm-hmm. phrases I was thinking of at once of what's going to happen in academic, just because having been through the academic computer science world, they're a decade behind on all of this stuff. They still mm-hmm. think that getting a patent on some technology and spinning out a for-profit company is the best way to fund a computer science department, and it's really, really kind of
yeah, sad. But I don't know that that's uniform at this point.
It's not uniform, but I think the places that aren't like that are the exception to the rule, because the people I talk to in academia are still thinking that way, at least recently.
Most of the people that I talk to in academia are already active.
Yeah.
Free software community.
I mean, and yes, that's true. And I think those people, I certainly know that I've talked to people who have had to shop around for a PhD program that
right.
would fit their ability to contribute to free software. You know, I've seen that at least once. And other times I've seen people really have to fight their advisor. I had to fight not my advisor, who was very supportive, but my department about free software when I was in grad school.
Well, if they are 10 years out, then they're going to just be starting to change.
Yeah, but it was so bad then. It's better, but still needs a lot of work now. Mm-hmm. I think generally speaking, I'm glad we didn't do a laundry list of business models in this. Mm-hmm. I refuse to let it happen. Because I think people should think in terms of, you know, how do I provide service to customers and how do I build a way to fund myself? I think if most software companies got started with how do I provide a service to users of this software and how do I fund just myself to do it?
Right.
If that's how people focus on starting software businesses, you almost can't go wrong in the free software space.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone I know who has done that in a free software project has had a very good project, very vibrant, very diverse code base over time, and they've never really been at a lack for work once the project got going.
Right.
So I think if anything comes out of my rants in these podcasts is build a small business to fund yourself if you want to make money in free software. Find a way to serve users well. You know, the customer is always right. That's a classic for-profit mm-hmm. thing to say. Find out what the customers want and try to find a way to do it under a free software license for them. And I think the business models will reveal themselves in a lot of ways.
That's probably right. Well, maybe next time we'll go to my rant.
Yeah, you haven't had a rant show yet.
I haven't, but...
Maybe it's because you don't rant. Maybe this is, actually a bad comment about
except
me.
Except that I've ranted several times to you in the last week about different free software issues.
That's
many
true.
Of which are...
They were private rants. See, I have this problem where I have to publicly rant.
Yeah.
Which maybe that's not so good.
Well, in this case, it's not a problem. It's... hopefully informative.
Isn't that what podcasts are for? It's just for people to publicly rant about stuff.
Well, thank you for joining us and listening to our collective rants.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
So if you net search for vegan butter, the third hit is there vegan butter that isn't gross?
And the answer is yes.
Well, that's good to know.